I'm Bill Barol. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 14, The Gorgeous Notebook Store.
Dear Matt, just over my right shoulder, about 6 feet away from where I'm sitting, there's a neat stack of pocket-sized notebooks leaning into a corner of a bookshelf. These notebooks are blank and unused. I've accumulated them over the years for one reason. They seem like the sort of thing I should have. I seem like the sort of person, professionally and temperamentally, who should always have within reach a notebook, because I'm constantly scanning the world around me for inputs and stimuli that I can use in my work. It seems like the natural, appropriate thing for someone like me to do. Now, do I carry a notebook? No, I do not. And it's for the most mundane of reasons. I just never got in the habit. If I stick a notebook in my hip pocket, it gives me the equivalent of butt padding and bedevils my sitting. Look, I deliberately stopped carrying a wallet there, and now I'm supposed to carry something even girthier? I mean, does that make sense? These are the little logical friction points that would drive my thinking about carrying a notebook, if I ever thought about it, which I don't. What I do, instead, is simply never carry or think about carrying a notebook at all, even though I am a person who professionally writes things down. And yet, here's where it gets weird. I continue to eyeball notebooks in stores and online. Beautiful little soft leather ones from Italy, their papers creamy and filled with promise. Stiffback ones with lay-flat bindings. Moleskines with beautifully gridded paper for the sketches I always mean to make, as part of the brainstorming I always mean to do. Sometimes I can't resist. I buy these notebooks, and I bring them home. And I place them on the pile, where they remain, blank and unused. We're talking in this episode about tools of the trade. Every trade has them. For a writer, these include not just notebooks, but pens. Look, it'd be silly, wouldn't it, to have all these notebooks I don't write in, and not also have a stack of pens to do my not writing with. My current favorites are the Frixion ball pens from Pilot, which I love not only because they have a name that sounds like something out of a Cold War monster movie, but also because they are fully erasable. And think about that. A guy who loves erasable pens to do his not writing with. Man, the irony. Then there are whiteboards, legal pads, post-its of every size and color. We all have tools we gather around ourselves to practice our crafts. Things that are, in the most immediate sense, useful. But that's only the beginning of the story. I'm proposing that those things can also serve one or more of a few subsidiary functions. They can be aesthetically appealing. We can just like how they look. They can affirm our identities. Or they can be aspirational. They can represent what we feel like we ought to be. My notebooks are like that. Here's another example of what I mean. John Lennon's most famous guitar was, bear with me while I geek out a little, a 1958 Rickenbacker 325. It's the guitar he played on the Beatles' first Ed Sullivan Show appearance in 1964.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Now, there are a couple of stories about how Lennon came to be interested in it. One is that he saw it on the cover of an LP by the great Belgian guitarist, harmonica player, and whistler, Toots Thielemans. Another is that he saw Thielemans playing it in a Hamburg nightclub during the Beatles' time there in 1960. There's general agreement, though, that Lennon spotted the guitar hanging in the window of a Hamburg music shop during that 1960 engagement. Give the last word on the origin story to Paul McCartney, who told BBC Radio, "It was a great-looking guitar, and I think in England you had to order them and wait for 6 months. Not just for Rickenbackers, for anything. Fenders, Gibsons. And I think it came about purely because John needed a decent guitar and that one happened to be in the shop, and he liked the look of it." So, it was an American guitar, hard to get your hands on, a status symbol for aspiring guitarists in Britain in the early 60s. Lennon may have heard it being played on the Thielmans album, or he may have simply seen it on the LP cover. It happened to be in the shop, and he liked the look of it. Did he go on to play this guitar on I Want to Hold Your Hand and I Saw Her Standing There? He did. But did it also appeal to him as an object, as a made thing, and represent the world of America he wanted to conquer? It did those things too. That guitar pulled double, maybe triple duty, in the way some tools of the trade do. I've noticed that you like a snappy suit. It's so much a part of your professional identity that the stylish t-shirts available at your online store, which I'm pretty sure is accessible at mattricardo.com/store, but gosh, please correct me if I'm wrong, those stylish and affordable shirts bear the slogan, fast hands, smart mouth, nice suit. So let me ask you, as we kick off this episode, about your stage wardrobe. What are the practical considerations, if any, that make it possible for you to do what you do? What part of it is a nod to the gentleman jugglers of the past? What part represents an aspiration? Or do you just like the way it looks? My professional wardrobe, at this moment, in case you're wondering, consists of a t-shirt Jennifer brought back for me after a recent road trip to Marfa in West Texas, and a pair of Bombas sweatpants. I guess it's just a good thing I didn't choose life on the stage. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill. Oh God, notebooks, the crack cocaine of the self-employed, the synthetic cannabinoid of the freelancer. I truly cannot imagine having the emotional resilience to be able to go to a stationery shop, stand in an aisle of notebooks and not buy some. I'm sure there are people who can do that, but then there are also people who can watch cricket, and I can't fathom that either. Notebooks are a good example of how a tool can have the exact opposite effect that you intended it to have when you bought it. You stand at the checkout with a beautiful new notebook in your sweaty clutches. Your mind swimming with all the staggeringly beautiful ideas you'll fill it with. A gorgeous leather-bound promise of artistic potential. This is all you need to nitro-boost your productivity. Oh, and a pen. Better go back and get a good pen. A couple of options. And colours. But then, you get home and you put your beautiful new notebook on the shelf with the others. They look so great up there on the shelf, the pages so blank, so terrifyingly blank. You can't just start writing in them, you'll need to wait for a particularly good project that justifies the money you spent on that nice notebook. If you're gonna spoil that perfectly unblemished first page with ink, then it had better be for something special, right? No. Nope. No. Notebooks want to be used. Pens need to be run dry. When you get that notepad home, don't put it on the shelf, put it on your desk, open. And the very next thing you need to write down, that's where it goes. Break the spell. Start the flow. Make a mess. Use the tool or it's not a tool, it's a piece of home decor. And the bonus here is the more you use your notebook, the closer you come to having a genuine reason to buy a new notebook. There's an old adage in the world of clothes and style and fashion, wear your best clothes the most often. It's not a perfect idea, as certain clothes are for certain occasions, but it's a good thing to have in the back of your head to help you avoid buying a nice suit and just letting it sit on a hanger waiting for the perfect occasion that might never come. Oh God, suits. The MDMA of the cabaret performer, the Zoloft of the shy person who wants to feel grown up. You ask what it is about me and my love of suits, and the truth is it's a lot of things, so let's go through them. It started, I think, as you correctly mentioned, as a nod to the gentleman jugglers of 100-ish years ago, who are one of the main inspirations for my work. Affecting the look and manner of a cool person about town is a nice way to present tricks, less as awful showing off and more as an extension of that coolness that you already look like you might have. There's also an element of going against how my art form is traditionally imagined. I'm a circus performer, but I don't look like one, and that's theatrically interesting. It's also annoying. People regularly watch my act, which contains no magic whatsoever, and call me a magician. because in their experience, a dude in a suit on stage doing tricks is a magician. And that perception is stronger than the fact that they literally watched me do circus skills and no magic. But I'm fine with it. Fine. But there's more to my suit fetish than that. I'm a working class boy, and there's certainly something in me that enjoys co-opting the visual language of the more privileged for fun and profit. I'm aware of the perceptions people have when they see a middle-aged white guy in a suit, and I enjoy playing with those ideas by not being quite what I look like. I used to really enjoy going into my street pitch in Covent Garden on the tube and being fairly confident that nobody would look at me on that journey and assume my job was busker. On top of all those things, I like how suits and their associated culture make me feel. With a suit on my back, I feel more adult, more confident, elegant, cultured. Learning how a well-cut suit hangs taught me how to stand stylishly on stage, what to do with my hands, how to come across less like the awkward person I was, and sometimes still am, and more like someone who, wherever I am, somehow looks at home. The way I dress helps me feel able to be myself, both on stage and off. However unsure or nervous I'm feeling, if I dress well, it gives me a plus one. I feel stronger, more able. Talking of fashion, I'm concerned that your only option for carrying a notebook is a back pocket. Sounds like you need a nice stylish day bag, a leather satchel of some kind with notebook, pens, phone charger, book. If you think we can get deep about notepads, just wait until we tackle bags. I am, as usual, sitting in my comfy chair by the window. The comfy chair is a tool. I love sliding into it with a cup of coffee on the windowsill to my right. The coffee, of course, is also a tool, both practical, in that it zaps me into doing this, but also ritualistic, in that it feels like a key part of my writing process. The laptop on my lap is obviously a tool, and all of these things come together to make me feel the same way putting a suit on does. Grown up. They help me feel that making something artistic is allowed and not silly. Little pieces of infrastructure for confidence. I guess all of these things are variations on dress for the job you want. The notebooks, the pens, the suits, the comfy chair and coffee, all rivets in the laying down of a track in the direction that we want to go in. So Bill, I challenge you to take your nicest, most expensive notebook down from the shelf and use it to make the notes for your next segment. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I like the way you intoned, no, nope, no, at the idea that a good journal is too pretty to be filled with random brain stuff. It's like you were talking to a Labrador puppy. Hey, speaking of that, our year-old lab, Dash, was spayed on Tuesday and needs a week in a cone to rest, relax, and recover. Keep her quiet, the vet said. Don't let her run around, the vet said. He also said she'd be narked out and groggy for the first couple of days. The good news is, she woke up feeling like herself this morning. The bad news is, she woke up feeling like herself this morning. You're a cat guy, so I don't know if this will resonate with you, but any puppy owners listening will surely know exactly what I'm talking about here. What I'm saying is, help. I'd never heard the maxim, wear your best clothes the most often, which should tell you a lot about the circles I run in, sartorially speaking. But I like it. I also like this one from the architect Louis Kahn. Even a brick wants to be something. So yeah, I guess you could say that a notebook wants to be filled. Although, sidebar, phrasing it just this way makes an image of a talking sentient notebook pop into my head, resembling the talking teapot Mrs. Potts in Beauty and the Beast. Am I the only one who found Mrs. Potts terrifying? Yes? No? Just me? Right. Back to notebooks. I wonder if part of the reason I have such trouble scribbling promiscuously in a brand new, unsullied notebook is that writers congenitally regard the blank page as something to be feared. I know the logical clapback to this, which is, hey, idiot, if you write on it, it isn't blank anymore, so you can stop peeking out from between your fingers. And this is true. Believe me, I understand the logic behind what you're saying. It's unassailable. The problem is, so is the damage done to my psyche by 40 years in journalism, the most pressing part of which is the abject terror that a blank page represents. The terror that says, you will not fill this. Not today. Not tomorrow. Not next week. You will never fill this. Your talent, if you ever possessed any, has flown. You are nothing. You can see how this would be intimidating, right? I can tell you anecdotally that of the journaling and notebooking adherents I know, very few of them are writers. Which is interesting, no? Some of them are designers, some run businesses, one runs a charity. My theory is that these are people who are sufficiently uncowed by the blank page that they can see it for what it is. A tool, one of many. Here's another one for your collection of quotes. A writer, Thomas Mann said, is someone for whom writing is harder than it is for other people. Needless to say, I wholeheartedly agree with this. You, a very good writer, you're going to want to wave this off in a self-effacing way, so let's just stipulate that you've done so and move on. You are an exception to this, which may be because you're not primarily a writer, by which I mean it doesn't define you, and you're not a prisoner to its psychological booby traps. You're more of a person who's polymorphously creative, and for a person like that, wrangling the many strands and tendrils of creative thought is a big job, and yes, a notebooking practice can help. I'm more of a one-trick pony in this regard. I saw that you recently commissioned a custom set of juggling balls, sewn in creamy red leather and stamped with your logo, all very bespoke. I admit that I wanted a set of my own, even though I'm an extremely amateurish recreational juggler. But hey, dress for the job you want, not the one you have, right? Which is, of course, another trap of tools of the trade. The self-justifying belief that ever more beautiful, sophisticated, and expensive tools will necessarily make you better at the job. Also, I was envious when I saw the Matt Ricardo custom series, envious of your being so deeply a master of your craft that it made sense to create your own tools, executed to your own exacting specifications. This is a level of mastery I can only aspire to. So let me live vicariously through you here. Tell me about what it's like to create from scratch the very thing you need to do your job at the highest level. I'll be right here taking notes on a scrap of paper because I don't want to bother any of the notebooks. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, I mean, you're not like a Labrador puppy. And I mean that in only a complimentary way and not just because you get taken outside to poop. Now, notebooks need to be filled in the same way the Amiglian talking cow in Douglas Adams's Restaurant at the End of the Universe would recommend its tastiest parts to customers. If you think a blank page is something to be feared, then you've never had your meal literally asking you to eat it. Thank you, by the way, for saying that I'm a very good writer. And yes, I think you might be onto something about my process. I still think of writing as my side hustle. In my various social media bios, I list performer before writer, so maybe that helps me to not subconsciously give it enough weight that I end up stuck under it, unable to actually do anything, like Stan Laurel under a broken piano. If I say it doesn't mean much, then it lets me get stuck into it with some kind of lightness of action, even though, just between you and me, it means a lot. You're also right when you reference that I make a few different kinds of things in different kinds of fields. I have, of course, toyed with naming a show Polymat, but have so far managed to talk myself out of it. If I know anything, and I may very well not, but if I do, then it is, as I'm sure I've said before, if in doubt, make. So perhaps because of that little motto, I'm good at just charging at filling that page regardless of quality or mission statement, and maybe not regarding those things is a good way to find them? You asked about my new juggling balls. Okay then. I have, as you can imagine, during a career that started sometime in the mid-Edwardian era, gone through lots of juggling balls. They get lost, they get stolen, they get worn out and start to look scruffy. They also, on one occasion, get ripped apart by customs agents convinced they were filled with some kind of contraband, which certainly gave the gig I was on my way to an extra set of challenges. The balls I've just taken delivery of are by far the most expensive I've ever had. As you say, custom made to my exact specifications, size, weight, colour, even how firm they feel in the hand, all carefully determined by me. And yes, they have my name and logo stamped on them because show business. I sprung for these so that I could have them optimized not just to my personal preferences, but also to the tricks that I do with them in my act. I do a few slightly difficult body bouncing tricks, so having them slightly underfilled means those tricks are slightly easier to perform. I juggle 5 for quite a long time in my show, so a little less heavy means that my arms won't get tired. Nice and big though, so they look good under a spotlight. And red, a mid-colour that will be equally visible in front of a dark or light backdrop. So those are the technical reasons, but more than that, the chunk of cash I dropped on them will make sure that I commit to using them until they get lost, stolen, or die. I've got the best balls for my style of juggling, so I have no excuses not to learn some new tricks with them to get better at what I do with them. I've invested in the best tools so that I can't be a bad workman and blame them. They will make me better at what I do in both the short and longer term, and if they don't, it'll be my fault. So they will. It's the juggling equivalent of buying the best clothes and wearing them the most often, or buying a gorgeous notebook and immediately starting to write in it on your journey home from the gorgeous notebook store. These are not decorative knickknacks, they're tools, and they will help you, and they're to be used until they break. And it makes me sad that one of the things your years of journalism, years of writing excellent funny things has left you with is a fear of the blank page. A career of being able to do something well over and over again has left you with, I guess, the recurring feeling that maybe you've used up all your good and won't be able to do it this time. But of course, the only reason why that might be true is that you think it might be true. Actual basic rational analysis would tell you that it isn't. If you mostly couldn't do it, then you wouldn't have had a decades-long career as a writer. But I suppose the truth is that in the locked room of one's mind, feelings often beat facts. But I could be wrong. I'm full of confidence when I'm about to go on stage because I know I've done it over and over, enough times to be fairly sure that I know what I'm doing, but writing still isn't my main thing. So it's entirely possible for my stupid internal narrative to tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. I sure can put those nice new red leather balls up in the air, though. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, the writer Calvin Trillin has a theory I've always been attracted to. According to Trillin, if you have your eye on some silly, frivolous thing you don't need, let's say for argument's sake it's a silly, frivolous thing that costs $200, and if you eventually decide not to spring for it, you are now up $200. That $200 is profit, free and clear, and may be applied to anything you like, say, the next shiny thing that comes along and catches your eye. That Mocha Master Technivorm coffee machine, the one that's handmade in the Netherlands? It's true that it costs $350, but look, I have this credit on my books for $200, which makes the real cost of the coffee machine just $150. It's a bargain! I love this theory, because it allows me to apply a thin veneer of seeming logic to my worst impulses. Similarly, I'm finding myself drawn to your notion that the best tools really do up your game. So, let's drill down on that for a second. Is it self-justification to believe that a newer, more advanced version of a tool will help you make better work? It is, I think, but in some cases, it's also true. One of the YouTube rat holes I fell down during the COVID lockdown was videos by some fantastic fine art furniture makers in the hills of Japan. There's something magical about seeing these guys start with a log, I mean a literal log of black walnut, and end up with an exquisitely executed dining table. It's hard to argue that a 5-horsepower, 20-inch helical head wood planer doesn't allow those craftsmen to work more efficiently. It's different with writers, though. Writers like to say that all they need to do their job is a pen and a notebook. And that's true. And the advantages of that lightness are obvious. You can get in and out of a place, do your thing quickly, without being tethered to power or needing a big scaffolding of infrastructure around you. But it's also true that that lightness, that functional simplicity, limits the headroom available to us. A pencil is more or less always going to be a pencil. A notebook, a notebook. You can invest in a Waterman pen and a handcrafted leather journal from Italy, but are they really going to make you write any more lucidly? I think you're arguing that they will. And as appealing as that notion is, I mean, look, I like the Trillin thing, but to be honest, I don't really need a justification to treat myself. As appealing as it is to think that ever more luxurious tools will make a writer sharper, funnier, more readable, I'm not sure that's true. What you're talking about is a psychological trick, a sort of mental jujitsu, in which you bring your game up to the level of your tools. But for a writer, the game is always the same. It takes place in the square meter of real estate between their ears, in their talent and their experience, which are the same whether they're doing calligraphy with that waterman or scratching out notes with a stolen ballpoint on the back of a fast food receipt. Not that I've ever done that exact thing. But you get the point. What I'm saying is, for somebody who's so extremely suggestible, full disclosure, I bought the handmade Dutch coffee maker, there are limits. There are tricks I just can't play on myself, no matter how much I may want to. Now, having said that, I appreciate you trying to talk me down from the fear that grips me when I sit down to a blank sheet of paper, although writers may need to rethink that trope unless they're working on an old-time typewriter. A blank, glowing screen, let's say. Better. In the locked room of my mind, as you put it, and not just mine, I think this is a fairly common pathology among writers, in that locked room, fear runs the show. So I guess it's a good thing we keep it locked? I'll talk to you next time.
Dear Bill, my friend Mick Foley didn't need any special tools to write his New York Times number one bestseller, Have a Nice Day, Tales of Blood and Sweat Socks. He wrote all 760 pages, longhand, in big notebooks and on scraps of paper, while sitting on planes, bumping around on buses and after work in hotels, as he toured the world wrestling for the WWE. And if you haven't read it, even if you have no interest in the spectacle of the squared circle, you really should. It's great. So you're right that tools don't make you a better writer. Mick was good and would have been good using any tool. They don't make you a better writer, but maybe for some people they do? Better tools don't make you write better. But I think, depending on your personal mindset, they can make you write. Like, actually do it. Again, it depends on what kind of person you are, but the way my brain works is that I figure, well, I spent money on this, I better bloody use it. I can't escape the feeling that buying a good notebook or pen or laptop or whatever is an investment that I'll need to pay off by making something with it. Perhaps I'd feel guilty about not getting the most out of the things I paid for. That seems healthy? And I'm not saying I need good tools when I write, but I still think of myself, certainly when it comes to writing, as a hobbyist at best. My low self-esteem tells me I'm playing at it, that I'm not a real writer, so having good tools for the job goes a little way maybe to convincing me that I should be doing this, that I'm allowed to. It's a way of dressing for the job I want, a way of saying to my subconscious, look, I have these, so I must be that. Again, seems probably healthy. In that way, the tools don't make me any better a writer than I already am, but I think they stop me from losing confidence and becoming a worse one. But that's just me. And as someone in a film once said, people are different. Hairstyles change, interest rates fluctuate. If we've learned anything while making this podcast, it's that there's no right or wrong way to be creative. You just gotta do you, as long as you know what you're doing. But this episode is supposed to be about the tools of the trade, so I thought I'd leave you with a vaguely related story. A few years ago, just before the pandemic, me and my better half spent a nice long weekend in Amsterdam. We'd been to Amsterdam many, many times in the past, but never to the Van Gogh Museum. Van Gogh? Van Gogh? Van Gogh? You know who I mean. Anyway, so we went. And it was, fairly obviously, fantastic. I mean, it was rooms full of the work of a great, skilled, visionary artist, so of course it was fantastic to see those canvases up close, to see them glow, and at the same time, to be reminded of his story, his pain, his struggle, the people around him who loved him and helped him keep making things until he couldn't anymore, to appreciate the art and the artist at the same time. Just before we left, I found myself standing in a corner of the gallery in front of a small glass case, sobbing my eyes out. In the case were some of the tools of his trade. A few little old metal tubes of paint, half used. If you pressed your face to the glass and strained your eyes, you could see the shape of his thumb where he had squeezed the paint out of the tube. And for some reason it just destroyed me. These paints, literally throwaway objects that he wouldn't have given a second thought to once he'd got his colours out of them and onto the petals of a sunflower. And here I was, 130 years later, staring at his thumbprint in the aluminium and feeling closer to him than I had any right to. So maybe, after all this talk about having the best tools, it's not really about that at all. Perhaps it's about putting your imprint on whatever you have, pressing your thumb into it, making your mark, using the things you can afford, the things you have, or the things you can steal, to do the thing that only you can. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.